My name is Deborah Thomas. I'm David Morris's sister. David Morris is the man wrongfully convicted for the Clydach murders in South Wales.
Can you tell us about those murders and how it ended up coming to David's door?
Basically, Mandy Power, her mother, and our two children were murdered. My brother's connection with Mandy Power was that his girlfriend at the time, Mandy Jewell, and Mandy Power were best friends. My brother was seeing Mandy Power, not in, they weren't in a serious relationship. It was just casual sex now and again.
Sorry, I think we ought to say, Deborah, that this all took place in Clydach, which is near Swansea, back in June 1999. I mean,
Yes.
how many people were actually murdered there?
They were all battered to death with a pole.
And how did this then come back to David?
Well, this is that it came back to my brother because he left his chain there the morning before because he had a relationship, like I said, with Mandy Power. He was on his way to get his chain fixed and he saw Mandy instead and went back to Mandy's house. So because they had the sexual relationship, his chain, he was waiting for Mandy to get changed upstairs. I need to explain the reason why his chain was left there. Mandy went upstairs to get changed. My brother was downstairs waiting for her, and he was playing with his chain. And that's how he left it there, because he put it down, went upstairs with Mandy, had sex with her, and he didn't realize he had left his chain there till he was getting on the bus to come over to my mother's. He put his hand in his pocket to get the change. And he realized he'd left his chain there.
So this chain, the police tied him to the murders. Well, that is understandable, but what evidence is there that maybe others were involved?
Right, okay, where do I start with that? The evidence, DNA evidence, which there was male DNA found, and we keep asking for the forensics and the DNA to be tested again. Unidentified male DNA was found there. Also, Alison Lewis, whom Mandy Power was in a relation with at the time, she was married to Stephen Lewis. Her DNA was found on Mandy's inner thighs. There was no DNA of my brother's found at all. But the connection is my brother was having an affair. Alison was a very, very jealous partner. Mandy Power was having a relationship with quite a few other people, not just my brother. So Alison was very, very jealous of Mandy, and she did used to fly into rages. So I'm sorry if I'm waffling, but there's so much to talk about. But Stephen Lewis was also, he knew that they were having an affair. He knew there was witnesses to say that he knew. He was having an affair. He even threatened Mandy, saying, "Stay away from my wife, or I will effing kill you." But that was discredited in court. All the evidence points to three others, not my brother.
So who were they, and were they arrested?
They were initially for the first year. They were three suspects: Stephen Lewis, Stuart Lewis, two serving police officers. Alison Lewis, Stephen Lewis's wife, she was an ex-police officer, no longer serving, but she was an ex-police officer. They were police officers at the time, and they were the three main suspects. And then a year later, my cousin was a very, very close cousin to us, was out one night and a plainclothes police officer, not even plainclothes, she was out, I think, just having a night out. And my cousin said that my cousin was seeing Mandy and he left his chain there. And that's how it got back to the police.
So, is there any evidence that the police were responsible rather than David?
Yes. All the evidence pointed to them.
So, what sort of evidence?
Well, it was a e-fit. Somebody saw Stephen that night. There was an e-fit done the very next day. That was never produced to the public. Martin Lloyd Evans was on Crime Watch, never produced the e-fit. Like I said, Stephen Lewis's brother was on shift that night. He went missing for 4 hours. He never went to court. He never explained his actions. He lost his logbook. He lost the car log. He was never called to court to explain himself. There was, like I said, unidentified male DNA. In Stephen Lewis's first statement, he said he'd never been in the house. Further on down the line, his statements changed. He said he'd been in every single room, might have touched the pole when he was moving a tumble dryer, and he might have touched the matches when he lit the cooker. The cooker was electric. There was witnesses. There was other witnesses who saw Stephen Lewis that night, two other witnesses. There was probably more, but they didn't. Whether they came forward or not, we don't know, because statements and whatever has gone missing. We've since found out that the prosecution held evidence back under the Public Interest Immunity Act for what reasons we don't actually know yet, but we need to get those files. But all the evidence points to the other three, not my brother. There is literally no DNA of my brother. There's no sightings of my brother. The motive that the prosecution gave my brother going that night was for sex. He was apparently high on drugs and drink. He was rebuffed. Mandy rebuffed him of sex, and he killed them all. He went and killed them all. Absolutely ridiculous.
Okay, so if the police are involved, is there any evidence to put those officers actually on the scene? I mean, you've mentioned DNA, but I mean, surely someone would have seen them.
Well, they did. They saw Stephen. There was witnesses who saw Stephen.
And was he in a police vehicle? Was he in his police uniform?
Walk in. There was three witnesses, actually. One went to court. The others are new witnesses. One of the witnesses, he was a taxi driver, and he saw Stephen that night. He made two phone calls to the police station, and both times he was ignored.
Well, you mean afterwards, so to sort of report it?
Yeah, just after the murders, yeah, he reported it. The other witness who saw Stephen that night, he literally nearly ran him over. But he wasn't, he was young. He used to get into a little bit of trouble himself. So he had a lot of threats made to him by the police to basically say nothing. So he was frightened to come forward. And he's obviously, he was in the programme. He saw Stephen Lewis that night, and he was too frightened to come forward at the time.
So just run over again what you think, if Stephen Lewis was behind this, what the motive was.
Well, there's no doubt about it. He knew his wife. Apparently his wife, well, not apparently, there were statements saying that Alison was leaving Stephen for Mandy. And that night, I think it might have been that night that she was going to leave him. I'm not sure, but she was going to leave him. So I think he was obviously very upset and jealous and whatever else he felt, enough to murder the family. Doris was proven to be killed first. Somebody was in the house waiting for Mandy to come home. Doris was proven to be killed first, apparently by the forensic blood on the pole. And then when Mandy came home with her children, the person was in there waiting for him and killed those three. But the person that went in that house, I mean, the three of them are involved. I'm not saying which one it was because I don't actually know that, but the three of them were involved. But the person who committed the murders knew the house well, because when Doris was killed, the pole was lifted up and they blew the lights. So they went into the children's room and took a TV off a chair that was in the children's room to take it downstairs to reset the electrics that had blown, the lights that had blown. But they needed a chair to reach the electrics. And obviously knew the house well. The TV was picked up by the murderer, and that was also incinerated.
Okay, so what's the state of play now? Obviously, you've been trying to get some kind of appeal or review of justice.
Well, we've been putting good grounds in front of the CCRC, and they haven't done their job. They just haven't looked at it. They were good enough grounds, but they didn't look at it. They haven't treated it or looked at it properly. They're just not fit for purpose, in my opinion. But we've had good grounds. We've been asking for the DNA to be tested again. We want all the forensics to be independently tested, but we're getting nowhere. So we want pressure put on South Wales Police to do their job properly, because South Wales Police shouldn't have been investigating their own, and we know information was being given back to the Lewises by their own. It should have been locked
out.
How do
you know that?
There's evidence. It's not rumours, there's evidence.
And there is an aspect to this case which is almost unique in that, if a man's wife is leaving him for a lesbian lover, he's likely to be probably more enraged than he would even if it was for another man.
It's the embarrassment factor as well, really, isn't it?
So do you think that played a part?
I think so, yes. Yes.
Clydach, is it a village, a town? What kind of people live there?
It's a village. It's a very close-knit village.
And what do people in the village think?
Well, actually, we've never really had any problems as a family ourselves because we've had more support than problems. And I could walk through Clydach tomorrow with no problem because people believe actually in Clydach that my brother is innocent.
Is there any chance, any hope, do you think, of one of these, either Stephen, Stuart or Alison Lewis, actually being put on trial for this case?
Well, we seriously hope so, yes, because they had more to be accountable for because they were never tried. All the evidence pointed to them and they were never tried for it. As soon as my brother came on the scene, they completely forgot about those three and focused on my brother. There was no DNA on my brother. There was no motive. There was no sightings. It was nothing. Only the fact his chain was left there. His chain was found under a plate. If it was ripped off Mandy's neck, it would have been found on top of something. But the chain was found underneath a plate and a wire, a TV wire, I think a cable. It was underneath, not on top.
Okay, so can you tell me a bit about your brother and also how he's getting on in prison?
I think my brother was a brilliant candidate, basically because he's been in trouble in the past. He's nothing serious, nothing, to say he was a murderer, nothing like that. But, he used to get in petty crime kind of thing, cars and whatnot. So he had a criminal past. So I think he was a fantastic candidate to be fingered for the crime, but my brother's nothing like the monster they made him out to be. He's nothing like that at all. He was close to my mother, close to my father. He was a good father, is a good father. I'm so close to him. We were close growing up. We were a close family, a very close family.
Have you been to see him in prison?
Yes, he's been in prison for nearly 20 years now. The only time we haven't seen him is with this COVID.
And how's he getting on in there?
He's okay. He stays strong for us and we stay strong for him. It's really difficult to explain what it's like, but he stays strong for us. And like I said, we stay strong for him.
If this is a miscarriage of justice, can you tell us something about the life outside jail that he's missed now?
Well, he's got grandchildren he's never seen growing up. My mother passed away last year through vascular dementia, which I strongly believe was brought on by the stress that she was under every single day. He's missed out on everything. My husband died 12 years ago. I needed my brother. Obviously, he wasn't there, only on the phone. He's missed out on life, everything.
And if people are interested in following this, what can they do? Where can they find out more?
David George Morris on Facebook. Got 26,000 followers now.
Deborah Thomas, thanks very much for joining us.
Okay, thank you.
My name is Helen Higner. I'm a retired police officer now. I served 14 years nearly with Greater Manchester Police. When I left, I decided that I was going to start a foundation to assist people who had been victims of police abuse. And in doing that, I was researching something else when I came across the Clydach murders case. And my mind, I just completely got engrossed in that case. And 3 hours later, I'd realized I'd forgotten about the other case I was dealing with, because this case was just, there were so many rabbit holes and so much information that I was reading, and I couldn't believe what had happened. So I was just doing more and more research on it to find out whether, you know, what I was reading was believable.
What do you make of the case?
It's without doubt for me one of the worst miscarriages of justice within the whole of Great Britain, you know, and one of the worst crimes to have occurred within our country as well. You know, for two little girls to be brutally murdered along with their mother and their grandma, three generations of one family just completely wiped out in one night.
I mean, how can it possibly be that we have such a miscarriage of justice in this particular case?
Police officers seem to be involved. You know, the evidence seems to point towards them, and nothing towards the person, David Morris, who is behind bars for this crime. You know, and when police officers commit crime, people don't want to know that the people who are supposed to serve and protect them are capable of doing something as heinous as this. And that's why I think one of the reasons that it's been covered up for so long, and this happens back in 1999 as well, when South Wales Police had a huge history of miscarriages of justice. You know, the Cardiff 3, the Lynette White case, the Sandra Phillips case, the Philip Saunders case, you know, the list goes on and on as to how many miscarriages of justice South Wales have been party to. So this happened around about the same time as that, when they were trying to tell the public, we're trying to turn over a new leaf, forget the history and let's move forward. But this happened right on that pinnacle of time. And not only do they want to not let the public know these three people could have been involved in this crime, it would have contradicted the very message that they were trying to give the public, that they were moving forward. So there's many reasons why I think this case has been covered up, really.
As an ex-officer yourself, how easy would it be to either fit somebody up for a murder or any other crime, or actually manage to make it so that police themselves can avoid prosecution for something that they've done?
You know, I think there's something within the police force which, you know, I describe as intergenerational subculture, and it's passed down from generation to generation, just like within a family. And that, you know, that's no different within the police, because you believed that this is a family, and, you know, you back each other up and you cover each other's backs with things. And specifically in this case, you know, everybody's even admitted that they all worked together at some point. You know, so Martin Lloyd Evans, who was the superintendent, had actually been a supervisor and worked with the three police officers, I believe. You know, so they've already got personal relationships and professional relationships. And we all know, just from personal experience, if your friend or your child or something might, you know, do something a little bad, you might want to cover for them. And I think that's what's happened here. They've got personal relationships with people. The generation, the subculture, the peer pressure, peer culture, it's all intertwined. And those relationships benefit you if you need help and assistance.
Well, they may wish to protect Stephen Lewis, of course. Absolutely. But the only trouble is that in order for that to work its way through the criminal justice system, they have to find somebody to take the rap.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think David Morris was the prime candidate for it. You know, he had a checkered past, nothing serious, but he got into a bit of trouble sometimes, and he just kind of fell in their lap for them, really. And it's a very, very sad story what has happened to David.
What hope is there for Deborah and other members of the family of David that something will be done about this? Because it does seem as if the wheels of justice have ground to a halt now.
No, you know, the evidence is on their side without a shadow of a doubt. You know, Deborah said that there was witnesses on the night to put them close to the vicinity of the murder. Someone had an e-fit. One of the twins was picked out in an ID parade as well.
Sorry, who are the twins?
The twins are Stephen and Stuart Lewis. They're
Stuart.
Twin brothers.
Okay.
Yes, yeah.
Right. And these were both police officers, yeah.
Yeah, they were both serving police officers at the time. So the evidence is there. And even Alison Lewis's DNA was found on the body of one of the victims, Mandy, that was found on her inner thigh and unfortunately on a sex toy that was inserted into her as well. So this physical evidence that's there, and there was also a handprint that was found near the VCR, and it was hands that had been placed in a glove, and then the hand had been put on the carpet and it had left a handprint behind. And they tried to match David Morris's handprint up with this, and it wasn't a match at all. And even in court, you know, the Home Office advisor, Peter Swan, who is an expert in fingerprints and handprints, said that no finger of that print belonged to David Morris, but he could not rule out Alison Lewis, you know. So it was a small handprint near the VCR. So the evidence is all there, and there's absolutely nothing for David Morris. It's all circumstantial for him. No DNA, no fingerprints, absolutely nothing that can place him there at the time of the murders.
But Helen, a jury decides these things, not you and I.
Absolutely. But if the jury were given all of the information at the time, then maybe they wouldn't have come out with a guilty verdict. And unfortunately, they weren't given all the evidence at the time. And that's a massive issue in this case, and it just shows.
I mean, yeah, but what particulars withheld then?
Well, the DNA evidence, South Wales Police actually said that there was absolutely no more DNA found at the scene of the crime other than that of Alison Lewis's. However, a number of years later, in 2014, I believe, it actually came out that there was male DNA evidence found at the scene. This has been tested, as basic as it could at the time, against David Morris's DNA, and it's not a fit at all. So he's, if you look at that evidence that's been found, David Morris is not a fit. So it basically eliminates him from being a perpetrator of this crime.
And the jury never knew that. So maybe another jury needs to have another look. What do you think?
Absolutely. Well, you know, there's already been two submissions to the CCRC to take another look at this case. And they keep coming back with it won't change the outcome of a trial should another trial happen. Now, that's not their job. They're there trying to act as the Court of Appeal. Surely it's the Court of Appeal's job to say whether there is enough evidence to either acquit David or to send it back for a trial. It's not the CCRC's job to do that. And what they need to do is send it back to the Courts of Appeal, because every time we do submit the applications, it's with new evidence. So they need to send it back to the Courts of Appeal for them to do their job and see where it goes from there.
So when is David due out?
Unfortunately, David is never going to be coming out as long as the sentence stays as it is. We believe he will be out because we do believe that we will get the CCRC to send the case back to the Courts of Appeals. If David admitted to the crime that he hadn't committed, he would be eligible to be released from prison. However, he's adamant he's not committed this crime, so he will never admit to the fact that he has committed this crime just to be released earlier. He said he'd rather die in prison than admit to a crime he's never committed. And that's pretty powerful to me, considering he's got children, that he's missed 20 years of their lives. He's not seen any of his grandchildren grow up. You know, that's quite a powerful statement, really, considering he's still quite young.
It certainly is. I mean, you might want to have something to say, Helen, about this whole idea. I mean, effectively sounds like a kind of plea bargain to me. If you plead guilty, it's going to be easier on you, whether or not you did it.
Absolutely. You know, and they're basically trying to put a carrot, dangle a carrot in front of him, you know, admit you've done it and you'll get released earlier. You can see your family. No, not a chance. You know, would he rather stay in prison and have these infrequent visits with his family, or admit to a crime of such heinous, you know, the act is just incomprehensible what happened, and go and see his family and people think of him as this person who committed that crime? No, I think he's making the right decision, considering he didn't commit the crime.
At the moment, we've got coming out. It's not probably going to be shown on television or maybe in most cinemas. It's called Ultra Violence by Ken Farrow, the director, about police killing people who are not in custody. It follows up a film he made back in 2001 called Injustice, about deaths in custody. And the list is rather horrific, and the murders, effectively, or killings or executions by the police, as some might call them in the film Ultraviolence, are also horrific. That is one of those films that you don't necessarily want to take the kids to see. It's a but there is quite a culture in Britain, isn't there, of making sure that the police do not get prosecuted when it comes to deaths in custody and deaths outside custody, Helen?
Absolutely. You know, I don't actually think there's been a prosecution, has there, for many, many years.
Well, I think what Ken Farrow says is that there's been one prosecution that they uncovered for death by a police, of course, by a police officer. And I'm not quite sure what the outcome was. And that is since the Second World War. And there's been something like, I think it's 600 deaths in custody and outside custody, which could and maybe should be treated as manslaughter or murder. But, you know, this is quite a problem. It's happening, just happened the other day in Swindon. Somebody who was reported to the police as they thought they had an air gun in 2 o'clock in the morning was shot dead by police in the street. And one does wonder if maybe, you know, there could have been an arrest there rather than someone being killed in the street. So this sort of thing is happening quite a lot. What's your experience of this? Because we've also got this whole situation with the police now, is that they're told that in many cases it's better to shoot to kill rather than, say, for example, try and maybe shoot somebody's legs, bring them down, and actually bring them in. Because the trouble here, I suppose, this is what point I'm very slowly meandering towards, Helen, is that, you know, without a victim, there is no actual trial. What you get is an inquest, and you don't get all of the circumstances looked at properly in court.
Absolutely, I completely agree with that. And, you know, you only need to look at the Anthony Granger case over in GMP. I think it was 7-8 years ago now, where he was, you know, a person who had a checkered past, and he was in a car that had been stolen, drove from Manchester into Cheshire, and he ended up being shot through the windscreen into the chest and killed by Greater Manchester Police as well. And when they've looked into this case, the evidence, the intelligence that they used was years out of date. You know, we're not just talking months or a year or so. It was years out of date that they've used for this person. And then they've tried to justify using this evidence in this shooting. But then the assistant chief constable, who had dealt with this case, who had put all the intelligence package together, after the fact had gone and changed his pocket notebook and other evidence, updating it to try and clear or to try and justify the actions that the officers took. Now, 8 years later, there's still no action that's been taken against him. And in fact, GMP took no evidence to a misconduct hearing. They didn't challenge it. So the case was dismissed, and nobody to date has been charged for his murder. Nobody. And that's what it was. It was murder. They acted on outdated information, outdated intelligence. And you're right, they are told to shoot to kill. But, you know, where's the justification in that? Because you look at this case now, and there's a man dead on their shoot to kill order. And it's outdated.
No, you've done a book called The Truth Behind the Uniform. Can you just maybe take us through some of the things in your specific experience that you saw that maybe raised your eyebrows a bit within the police force?
Yes. Well, I joined the police back in 2003. And almost immediately when I joined my team, you know, I noticed colleagues behaving inappropriately. And when I say inappropriately, we went on a night out. And there was a Sikh gentleman there who was wearing his turban, and they were making monetary bets to see who would steal this gentleman's turban. But they were using derogatory terms. So, they were putting £10 in, £20 in, you go and steal the, you know, gentleman's turban, but they were using derogatory terms. I challenged this behaviour, saying, you know, you can't do this, we're police officers. I was literally 4 weeks with my team at this time, if that. But they were laughing at me, telling me I'm not a team player. And they got up to £200. And one of the guys, police officers, was just about to steal this gentleman's turban. And I was looking around, you know, for one of my colleagues to help me. And they're just all laughing and joking. So I saw my sergeant, who was over at the bar. And I went and told him what had happened. And he was absolutely furious. Came over, you know, told them all to stop it and get out, and that he would deal with them all the following day. But then we moved on to another pub, and one of my colleagues came over to me, and almost immediately he took his penis out of his trousers and started masturbating in front of me, and making derogatory terms about me and how much I would want that. I asked him to stop, and again he just laughed at me and called me a prude and not a team player. And then it was one of my senior colleagues that saw what he was doing, came over and told him to stop it. And he walked away making derogatory comments about me, and I just left. And that was literally 3-4 weeks, you know, being on my team, that this had happened.
Amazing. I mean, this was in Greater Manchester Police, but have you any evidence that there's similar sorts of practices go on in other police forces?
Since I've started, building my foundation and speaking to other people, and my book came out, I've been contacted by police officers up and down the country. A lot of them have left to say that they'd encountered, you know, racism, sexism, homophobia within the police force. They challenged it and nothing was done about it. And they too had then been victimised and bullied for challenging the system, for challenging their colleagues. And, you know, very, very similar situations to what I found myself in.
It does seem to me as if there's this culture of impunity that certainly in parts of the police force, I wouldn't say this is everywhere, but there is this feeling that actually as a police officer, you can do anything and get away with it.
Yeah, it does feel like that, you know, from the small things, you know, right up to the bigger crimes. Granted, there have been some colleagues that I've worked with who have committed crimes and they have gone to prison. But there's also a lot of colleagues that have done things and have never, you know, never been punished for the crimes that they have committed.
We've been talking about the Clydach murders and that as a miscarriage of justice. Are you aware of other miscarriages of justice in different parts of the country? Because I can remember back in the 1980s and 1990s, each of the main TV channels had its own documentary series dedicated to miscarriages of justice, where every week when the documentary season was on, you'd have week after week of miscarriages of justice. Really nothing now on television about these things, apart from maybe an occasional documentary, but there's certainly no consistent effort by journalists to constantly challenge the justice system. What have you seen in other parts of the country that's similar to the Clydach murders or other, you know, other sorts of miscarriages of justice, Helen?
There's quite a few. I remember one, I think it was, you know, this span over decades, obviously. There was one, you know, Timothy Evans. He was wrongly hanged for a murder that was actually committed by John Christie in 1998. A conviction was quashed, I think, for a gentleman called Derek Bentley, who was hanged in 1953 for his part in the shooting of a policeman. But his conviction, as I said, was quashed in 1998. Judith Ward, she was wrongly convicted of the M62 coach bomb in 1974, and she served 18 years in prison for that. You know, the Guildford Four, they had their convictions quashed in 1989. After serving 15 years in prison. Birmingham pub bombings took place on the 21st of November in 1974. You know, the list goes on and on.
Actually, the Birmingham case is in the news this week again. I mean, this is the trouble. When you get a miscarriage of justice, actually, that case never goes away. There are people who are suffering that injustice for decades and decades to come, generations of families.
Absolutely. And I think when the wrong person goes to prison for a crime that they've not committed, they're just another victim of that crime, you know, and And it's just awful that when we don't do a job properly, when the police don't do a job properly, or they force people into, you know, confessions, we're just creating more victims. And that's not what we're supposed to do as police officers. All they're supposed to do is follow the evidence. And sometimes it's quite clear that they've not followed the evidence, and they just want to put someone behind bars.
What about the complaints process? Surely there is some sort of place that people can go and say, well, actually, that was wrong.
Well, yeah, you first obviously start the complaints process by broaching the force that has wronged you. And then when you find no luck there, you can go to the IOPC. Now, the IOPC are supposed to be an independent body, and one would beg to differ whether they are an independent body when they hire retired police officers. You know, how independent are we going to get there? So there isn't really an independent body within the UK who can handle these type of complaints. And I think that's where we're falling down massively, is we have a so-called independent body that hires ex-police officers to investigate police officers.
Okay, so your book is The Truth Behind the Uniform, Helen, but what about your campaign? Because you're doing a campaign really which is looking at these miscarriages of justice across the country, aren't you?
Do you mean my foundation?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, my foundation is just to assist anyone who has been a victim of police abuse, so whether that be a miscarriage of justice or just something, you know, smaller compared to a miscarriage of justice, you know, when somebody's been stop searched for absolutely no reason, or they've been stop searched because they've been racially profiled. You know, that happens a lot within the police force. So it's just, you know, somewhere where people can come to, I can offer them advice, point them in the right direction of solicitors, counsellors, whatever they need, really. So they can hopefully find some justice from what they've been subjected to.
You know, in the back of my mind here is the honest police officer like yourself that finds themselves in a very murky world with actually, you know, people who could even be criminal officers around them, you know, criminal CID, people involved with organised crime, maybe taking two salaries, one from the public, one from organised crime. Is there any way that we can support ordinary officers that are just honest and trying to do their job in that kind of situation?
You know, there are some good police officers, without a shadow of a doubt. And I think, you know, it's hard to say how we can support them. But I think if we're approached by a police officer, we need to give them the same attitude test that they give you. You know, don't just, I know it's hard to say when somebody is stopped or believe that they're stopped for being black or homophobic, you know, of believe they are being victimized because they're gay. It's really hard for them to be polite when they're stopped yet again from another police officer. But I think we just need to treat the police officer courteous from the very first approach. And then if it goes wrong from there, then you can justify your resisting arrest or anything from, you know, from that point, really. Because there are some really, really good police officers. And I've got two friends that are still in the police and they're very, very good police officers. And the irony is one is Asian and one is gay. And they've both done the right thing. They've approached the force and complained about other police officers. And they're now both fighting for their job because they've challenged the system. So there are good police officers and we just need to try, you know, as the public and see how they interact with us first before we kind of abuse them back, I think.
Okay. Well, how do people find and follow your foundation and get hold of the book, Helen?
My book's available on Amazon. I'm in the process of putting a website up for my foundation, but I'm absolutely snowed under with so much work and trying to assist people. So if there's anyone out there that wants to help me get all that sorted out, then it would be greatly appreciated. But you can always find me on Facebook. I do have a page on there, Helen Elizabeth. My personal account, I get a lot of people contacting me via Helen Hicknett on Facebook, and I give them a lot of advice via that. So there are many ways, you know, in my book, my email address is there for people to contact me as well.
Helen Hignett, an absolute angel. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.